and Ms. Fitzgerald. And I would also encourage you, there will be a sign-up sheet, and you'll need to sign that, if you will, before you exit. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. My name is Eric Massoni from Chesapeake Public Defender's Office. I represent Jonathan Karika. My request is if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I would appreciate that.
Okay, certainly. Thank you.
This case was originally granted on a hearsay issue. Since then, I noticed there was an issue that concerned the trial court subject matter jurisdiction. I asked the court to consider that issue, and the court was gracious enough to grant that issue as well, but also raise a third issue, of course, of whether or not it was preserved under 5A18.
If it's not subject matter jurisdiction, then you haven't preserved your issue, have you?
Exactly right. So that was the first thing I was going to talk about.
So that's the bottom line, is whether it's subject matter jurisdiction.
I think so, Your Honor. I was looking at the case law. Unfortunately, I think a lot of the case law is somewhat circular and conclusory, that it's subject matter jurisdiction because it's subject matter jurisdiction, or it's not because it's procedural, is essentially what they tend to say. That being said, I was looking back at the cases. I had cited in the brief Cunningham v. Smith, but there's a few other cases. I don't believe I cited them, but they're all around the same time. I know K. V. Cunningham.
Circuit courts have the subject matter jurisdiction to hear criminal cases, don't they?
Yes, Your Honor, they do. The issue in the case is whether or not they have the power to hear the case absent intervention of a jury or absent waiver from the
and
court.
And that's not subject matter jurisdiction, is it?
I believe it is, Your Honor. And when I was looking at, I cite Smith v.
Subject matter jurisdiction, which says that the court can entertain any matters within that category, right? And then there is the authority of the court to exercise that jurisdiction, which is different than subject matter jurisdiction. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I respectfully do disagree. Just looking at the way the case law describes it, it's mandatory provisions of law that the court must do or else jurisdiction is not obtained. And it specifically says that the court has no power to try the case without this jurisdiction, and that without it, that the trial itself was void. That's what those cases said. It was void ab initio, not voidable. And the reason you can tell that is in these cases, they are all cases that turn on habeas. They're all basically, verdict was final, it was either exhausted appeals or they never raised the appeals in the first place. They filed a writ of habeas corpus, and in those cases, the writ was granted because the original order was void ab initio. If it was something that was simply voidable, back in the 1960s, I don't think habeas would have lied in that case. I think it's something that's different. And what the case it specifically says, that it's mandatory, it's got to be in the record, it's in the Virginia Constitution. That's basically what it says. And that's why I would argue that it is subject matter jurisdiction. I recognize that this court has had a different issue, a different opinion in a couple footnotes, or one case said another case with a footnote. That was the Smallwood case as well as the McCormick case. Those essentially just said that it was not preserved because of 5A18.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
That essentially what the McCormick said, cited a footnote that said this issue is not preserved, cites 5A18. I wanted to bring that court's attention because I agree that's what this court has said. That being said, I'm not necessarily saying it's the court's fault. I'm sure the parties hadn't raised the court's attention, but my position is that's inconsistent with Cunningham v. Smith, K. v. Smith, all these cases that dealt with the issue.
Well, counsel, suppose we agree that Cunningham is controlling and it's correct in terms of whether it's jurisdictional or not. How does the setting order not cure that?
So there's two points that I would make to that. One is, obviously, it's a very formal issue. It is a technical issue. I agree with that. But the way the procedure is lined out is it's got to be waiver by the defendant, waiver by the Commonwealth, concurrence by the Commonwealth, concurrence by the court, and it's got to be entered into the record. And
it doesn't say specifically in what form it needs to be.
Yes, that's correct. However, I think, once again, Smith is on point for that, because in that case it was an indictment, and on the back of the indictment, the court specifically wrote, defendant waives trial by jury with the concurrence of the court and the Commonwealth. That indictment was entered into the record, and the court said that this is not to say that because the indictment thus becomes a part of the record, it is then the record upon which may be entered the Basically, it doesn't become because it's part of the record, it doesn't mean that it's the record. And this was.
Didn't the court essentially come to the conclusion that meant that almost every indictment then could constitute as a waiver? It's a slightly different from the situation we have here.
Yes. I mean, certainly what they said was that's the indictment specifically is not the record. But at the same time, what they're talking about is they say entered in the order book. There's a bunch of different things that they talk about. However, my other point that I want to mention is all the continuance order says is if the defendant does not notify the court within 30 days, then it's deemed that he waives trial by jury. It certainly does not mention the court or the Commonwealth. Like I said, this is a formal procedure that's required for the court to obtain a jurisdiction, and at a minimum, the order would have to reflect the fact that the court and the Commonwealth waive it. But I would submit that even if that's true, deeming that it's waived is not the same thing as actually
counsel,
waiving.
Cunningham, McCormick, and Wright.
Yes, Your Honor.
Talk about that the conviction must be set aside. Is there any analysis in any of those three cases that distinguish between subject matter jurisdiction and potential jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor. Not that I could tell.
Well, if it's if there's an error in potential jurisdiction and you timely raise it, then an error would then authorize the conviction to be set aside. So how does that help us in analyzing whether it's subject matter jurisdiction or potential jurisdiction?
Well, I would respond with two points. One is in Cunningham, there's no indication that it was timely raised. The fact that it's raised in a writ of habeas corpus suggests that it wasn't timely raised. Second, you look at the nature of what they described it, the procedure. Third, I wanted to point out I did a quick Lexis search just to try to figure this out, just how often back in 1962 did the court talk about subject matter jurisdiction. And to be even broader, I started in 1950 and I ended in 1969, and in the entire two decades, the term subject matter jurisdiction is mentioned by the Supreme Court twice. I think that they use the term jurisdiction, and I don't necessarily think they made a distinction, so I know that doesn't help you today, but I think when you look at how they describe what the jurisdiction is in this case, that what they're talking about is subject matter jurisdiction. As a matter of logic, there was no other way for it to work.
I think it's a fair statement to say that early on, both this court and the Supreme Court really blurred the distinction between subject matter jurisdiction and potential jurisdiction. Is that a fair statement?
That may be, in fact, true. I don't know that for certain, but I still think when they talk about the power to hear the case and that if it's void ab initio, it comes back to the same thing. It's different from an issue
what
where it's voidable.
What case says void ab initio?
It says void. I don't believe it said void ab initio, but that would Smith v. Cunningham, that Cunningham v. Smith, that was exactly what the argument was, that it was void. And I suspect Cave, which I don't think is in my brief, says the same issue as well. Cave does, and I apologize, this would be 203 Virginia.
Cave is 203 Virginia,
yeah, 737. And that one says the court was without jurisdiction to try the case, and the order of the conviction entered on July 23, 1959 is void because of the failure of the record to show the Commonwealth attorney concurred in the waiver by trial by jury.
Right, and subsequent to Cave, you're right in what you're reciting, but subsequent to Cave, Supreme Court decided Nelson and Gamschleri or whatever, which is inconsistent with Cave, without reversing it.
I think it did deal with, I think if I recall correctly, Nelson did deal with different issues, though. So I don't think, because it didn't reverse it, I think it's just because it deals with a different issue, that this issue is subject matter jurisdiction, even if the issue dealt with Nelson is not. That would be my position. I do want to turn at least briefly to the merits of the issue, since, of course, the court was kind enough to grant the issue. It's a hearsay objection. Obviously, it's a fairly simple case. It was one side versus the other side, and it's just depended on who was believed in the case. The only independent evidence whatsoever was this 911 tape that defense counsel tried to introduce. I argued as defense counsel is not introduced, offered for the truth of the matter asserted. And I think if you listen to the tape, it essentially couldn't be without being cumulative. The alleged victim in the case said the exact same thing on the 911 tape that he said in court, and Mr. Karika testified to the same thing that was in the tape as well. What the proffered reason for the audio was just to simply show that everyone appeared calm, that it was an unusual circumstance for somebody who said that they were in fear for their safety to be so calm and to actually hand over their phone to the person they said they're afraid of so you could talk to the 911 operator. So that's essentially the hearsay issue. Obviously, since it was a case that just depended on credibility, it's the only issue besides the believability of the witnesses in the case. So that's why I thought it was important to consider. If there are no other questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. To start with the jurisdictional...
How do you get around Cave?
Your Honor, I think that the questions before the court today and in grappling with this issue, the older cases do sound like subject matter jurisdiction. Cave, Catlett, Smith are all post-conviction review cases. As was noted, Cave says that this order was void. However, the Supreme Court has developed its jurisprudence since then. I guess I should pause, Judge Frick. My answer is twofold. First of all, we have an order in the record which does show the defendant's consent to be tried by a judge. So even if this was a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, I think that this case, the record is sufficient to find that the defendant's consent and the court's consent and the Commonwealth's agreement was entered of the record. And if the court disagrees with me, I think the Supreme Court jurisprudence has developed to highlight that jurisdiction used to be used in a broad sense. The court mentioned Nelson just now in argument. I would also cite the case to Porter, which is a 2008 case, which I submitted as supplemental authority late yesterday afternoon, so I apologize for the delay on that. But in Porter...
Let me have that cite again, please.
Porter
versus Commonwealth.
And the site is 276 Virginia 203, 661 SE2D 415, 2008. And I did file that with the clerk's office yesterday and asked that it be forwarded to you all, so it should be in the court's file for your convenience.
But it's not.
I have a spare copy, Your Honor, if you'd like me to hand one up to you.
I would love that. Thank you. Thank you.
Porter actually talked a little bit about territorial jurisdiction and venue, but before going into the venue issue, the court laid out, there's a big block quote, and then it goes into more detail about subject matter jurisdiction being the authority to hear the case, and the term jurisdiction as a broader term encompassing territorial jurisdiction, encompassing the court's authority to exercise its subject matter jurisdiction and also notice jurisdiction. None of those things are subject matter jurisdiction. Critically, the Porter case also talked about how subject matter jurisdiction cannot be conferred by consent of the parties. And in this case, we certainly have the trial court's ability to hear the case by a bench trial is authority that is conferred by consent of the parties. And so the Porter case in 2008 does seem to clarify the Supreme Court's current stance on what is subject matter jurisdiction versus another kind of jurisdiction, even a mandatory requirements that the trial court has before they can hear a case. There does seem to be a distinction coming about, and to the extent that this court would find that the sentence scheduling order in this case doesn't satisfy the requirement of the Commonwealth's
position. Does Cunningham, McCormick, or Wright talk about subject matter jurisdiction?
Cunningham, McCormick, no. No, Your Honor, actually, I don't believe that any of them do. Again, the older cases speak in terms of jurisdiction broadly. McCormick does make a distinction there. Part of the issue was waived, but I'll note in the footnote the court says it's not going to reach the issue as to the sufficiency of the order in that manner, but the court does go on to reach the jurisdiction issue by saying that the record in that case had no indication the defendant had waived his right to jury and did end up reversing, although not for the reason framed in the assignment of error. The court nevertheless reached that jurisdictional issue and found that it was significant enough in that case to merit reversal. In this case, unlike that case, we do have on the record, again, the order that is signed by the defendant. We have the underlining in the order that says it's being set for a bench trial with the agreement of all the parties, including the defendant, who marked on the defendant's line in that order. We also have in the agreed statement of facts the defendant did appear before the court and waive his right to a jury trial. So this is not a case like McCormick where the record is completely devoid of any indication that those things happened. So to the extent that we have those things in this record, it's different. But McCormick doesn't speak to subject matter jurisdiction. I think that parlance was just maybe not part of the legal parlance at that time. But again, as we understand subject matter jurisdiction now, all circuit courts in the state obviously have jurisdiction to hear felonies committed within the Commonwealth, and they have appellate jurisdiction over misdemeanors, such as in this case. And I think that distinction is highlighted in Porter. It is highlighted in Nelson, where the court overrules its previous rulings, talking there about the juvenile and domestic relations court's ability to hear cases where the juvenile's parent hadn't consented.
I was sitting in juvenile court when that first opinion came out, which meant that every juvenile could raise that issue forever.
Yes.
And then the Supreme Court figured out that they were wrong and then came back with Warden to make the distinction between subject matter jurisdiction and potential jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. And I would submit this is a case that is that similar type of distinction. As highlighted in that Nelson case, as highlighted in Porter, these are important requirements. However, they don't affect the court's subject matter jurisdiction. And as a practical matter, it makes sense because that court has heard pretrial motions in this case. That court took the defendant's waiver. That court heard the full case and thereafter is supposed to enter a notation of record.
If the court, if there's subject matter jurisdiction, you can't consent to any aspect of the case, right?
Correct. And the judge in that case would have been moving along through the docket the whole time without jurisdiction, and that just doesn't seem as a practical matter to be the manner in which these cases are tried. It would fit in the context of like Nelson and like Porter, the court's jurisdiction in the sense that it's the court's authority to exercise its subject matter jurisdiction, and that would be an issue that would be avoidable and not void in this case, and then we'd be moving on to waiver. But I don't think that it impacts the subject matter jurisdiction in the way the Virginia Supreme Court is now defining it in the more recent cases. But this court certainly doesn't have to decide that because here, again, we do have this order, which is entered of record, and entered of record in the sense that Cunningham versus Smith speaks about. In Cunningham, the court distinguished between, as counsel noted, notations on an indictment and an order that was entered in the order book. Well, here we have an order that is entered in the order book. It's not notations on the back of another document in the file. This is part of the official record as the court understood it in Cunningham versus Smith, not some other type of transcript or handwritten notation. So in this case, and we don't have to have a formal waiver also, it's worth noting in this case there is no argument the defendant did not voluntarily waive his right to jury, and there is no argument that order itself didn't accurately reflect what happened in court that day. And all that the Constitution requires is that the defendant's consent to be tried by a bench, by the judge, be entered of record. And we certainly have that consent in the form of that pretrial scheduling order where he asks the court, as a moving party, to set the matter before a bench trial. And then later in the record does waive his right to a jury. And the Supreme Court in Wright v. Commonwealth, which is 2001, also relied on a pretrial order instead of a conviction order to find that the defendant's consent was entered of record. In Wright, the defendant had signed a waiver, and then the court later entered an order noting that all the parties had signed a waiver.
Isn't that different, counsel, than the factual pattern we have here, which is setting order? Because in Wright, it was actually an explicit acquiescence or agreement by the Commonwealth and the court to try the matter by jury.
Yes, Your Honor. However, I think there is a slightly different setup, but I don't believe that distinction is significant in this case. Because what Wright noted, which was important here, is that everyone's consent was demonstrated by their signature. And again, in that case, although we had a jury waiver and this is a sentencing order, whether the defendant voluntarily, intelligently waived his right to a jury, whether or the particulars of that process are not an issue in this appeal. This is not a case where we're talking about, does this order show the defendant intelligently, voluntarily waived his right to a jury? No. But that's not an issue in this appeal. What is at issue in this appeal is whether the record reflects that he consented to trial by a judge. And all that we need to show is that consent. So with that scheduling order, might not be sufficient to show he intelligently, voluntarily, knowingly waived his right to a jury trial.
It doesn't stop there, though, counsel. Isn't it also the requirement of the Constitution that the Commonwealth and also the court confirm with that waiver?
Yes, Your Honor. And in that order, that scheduling order that we have is signed by the court, and it's also signed by the Commonwealth. And if you look at the order, the underlines, it's a form order, but it has been adapted in this case. It is a motion by the Commonwealth and by the defense. So we have a joint motion for the case to be heard by a bench trial, and it is signed by the trial court, indicating the court's consent also in that circumstance. And the Wright case, likewise, relied on those signatures to show that the parties all consented to the order. So in this case, as in Wright, everyone's consent is demonstrated by their signatures on that order. And also, we have both the Commonwealth and the defendant as moving parties asking the court to hear the matter by a bench trial. So I think that that order is sufficient to show that all the parties, that the defendant consented and that the Commonwealth and the court concurred in that waiver. Briefly, to address the merits, this is a case where the trial judge did not abuse his discretion in admitting the 911 tape that was duplicative of the party's testimony that it heard before it. Again, admissibility of evidence is in the sound discretion of the trial court. The trial court here could have not accepted the defendant's proffered purpose for the 911 tape, or the court could have determined that the tape was cumulative, or it could have determined the tape was just bolstering. For any of those reasons, the court was well within its discretion to permit that tape, or to rather preclude that tape from coming into evidence. And even if this court were to find it was an abuse of discretion, the defense has stated on their brief, and I think we argued this as well, the tape mirrors exactly what the parties said at trial. And it's difficult to draw that contrast in a statement of facts case, but it appears that everyone's agreement that the defendant testified to what he testified to, and the victim the same. Everyone agreed that by the time the call was placed, the parties were calm, and I would submit it was appropriate for the victim to be calm at that point because he was in a vehicle, he had the window rolled up, and the defendant had stopped being aggressive towards him. And also, listening to the tape, the victim is calm in some points, but there is certainly agitation in his voice. He raises his voice at the defendant when the defendant tries to challenge his version of events. I think that his demeanor is certainly befitting of someone who had been through the experience that he went through. But even if it wasn't, again, the trial court had the benefit of the live testimony of both of the parties and could have easily determined that the 911 tape was cumulative. This court, in an unpublished opinion, had assumed that it was error and found harmless error. I think that was the Brown case, under very similar circumstances. And so that would be the Commonwealth's position there as well. I'm happy to answer further questions, or we can go back to the jurisdictional issue if I've left that unclear for the court. I'm happy to go back around there. I know it's a difficult issue, but possibly one this court doesn't need to reach if that other order is sufficient, whether it's subject matter jurisdiction or not. The requirements have been met.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzgerald.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, so I'll just be brief, and I promise I actually will be brief when I say those words. Obviously, we're looking back to cases from the 1960s where the court's language perhaps is not the same language they would have chosen today. On the other hand, those are the cases that are most directly on point dealing with this issue, and those cases make it clear that when it's not entered into the record, that the trial was essentially void, and that even if it was not...
But the Attorney General argued that it was entered into the record. You want to address that?
Yes, Your Honor.
The continuance order,
right,
and said that the Commonwealth and the defendant concurred in the waiver, and then the trial court entered the order.
I disagree with it saying that it concurred in the waiver. What the order, it's a scheduling order that all parties concurred in the scheduling of the case, and the order says that it selects a bench trial with the caveat that if a jury trial is not requested within 30 days, defendant is deemed to have waived his right to a trial by jury. I think that's quite different from an on-the-record questioning of a defendant where he actually waives the jury and the Commonwealth and the court agree, and then that's actually entered into the record.
Is your position that nobody waived jury or only the trial court didn't?
My position, I certainly concede that by requesting the bench trial in the statement of facts, I think it's actually a later date than that one where he requested the bench trial, that Mr. Karika himself certainly would have waived trial by jury.
What about the Commonwealth attorney?
I don't believe so, not based on that order. The order was just a scheduling order, and there's nothing in the order that says if the Commonwealth requests within 30 days, there's nothing about waiver for the Commonwealth based on that. At most, the court would have to find that the Commonwealth waived it through inaction, and that by entering this order, that retroactively enters into the record that they waived it, even though by definition they hadn't waived it at that point, because they could still, within 30 days, change their mind. So if there's no other questions, I ask that the court reverse and remand this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Masoni. We'll come down and greet counsel.